Welcome to Art for All, sponsored by Sketchbook School. As a thank you for joining us, I'd like to give you a free ebook and our monthly newsletter full of tips, recommendations, and other cool stuff. Just head over to sketchbookschool.com to claim your freebies and to learn more about our classes and workshops and our membership program. We believe that art is for everyone, and I hope our podcast inspires you to create and explore your own artistic journey. Thanks for listening. On with the show. Hi, and welcome to Art for All. I'm Danny Gregory, and I am the founder of Sketchbook School, and I'm also a person who enjoys talking to other creative people, which is what we do here in every episode. And this week, my guest is going to be an old friend of mine, Trevor Romaine, who is originally from South Africa, now lives in Kauai. And Trevor has devoted the last couple decades of his life to using his abilities as a storyteller and as an artist to create all kinds of things for kids to help them navigate all kinds of traumas. He's written books about bullying. He's created programs that are now used by the armed forces to help the children of veterans to cope with trauma. And he's also worked with children in hospice to deal with their last chapters. He's worked with child soldiers in Africa, all kinds of amazing things. He's a phenomenal person. I really love talking to him. And I'd love to have you join us. So here we go. Here's Trevor Romaine. All right, Trevor. So basically the idea behind this podcast is I have conversations with interesting people like yourself about creative stuff, and we'll see where it goes. It's not really an interview. It's more of a chat. You and I have been chatting, how long, 20 years? Maybe longer, 20, right?
Maybe longer. Yeah. Goodness. Yeah, nice. I think – yeah. How old is Jack?
28.
Oh, goodness. So, yeah, it's 25 years. I mean, he was
little. But we still look good.
We're trying, don't we?
At least one of us has most of his hair. So that's good.
Well, most.
So when we first talked, were you living in Austin at that point? I think so.
Yes. Yeah. I lived in Austin for 34 years before I moved.
Yeah. And now you live in Kauai.
I sure do. Yes. In the middle of nowhere.
What is that like?
You know, it's a mixed bag. I love it. It's incredible to be in a beautiful place visually. I mean, every morning when I wake up and I see mountains and palm trees and greenery, this particular island gets the most rainfall in the world, gets over 400 inches a year,
but that's bad.
In the mountains, just up in the mountains. They filmed a Jurassic Park here, so that's basically what it looks like. You know, the thing is that there's only a few stores. There's no art store. There's, you know, stuff has to be ordered. Costco is the only big entity here, and you have to drive an hour to get there. So it's you know. It's a balance, but it's really it's inspiring to me. Instead of finding it restricting, I find it inspiring.
Does it remind you of Africa?
It sure does. This particular area reminds me of Natal, a town called Durban in South Africa, and it's oftentimes I'll be driving along the road and I'm back to being a little boy going on our annual vacation to Durban. Yeah.
It's funny the way that works. Yeah. I don't suppose Austin reminded. Did Austin remind you of Africa?
You know, Austin was interesting. It didn't, but there are just the way the people were in Austin were very similar to the people in Johannesburg where I grew up. Now it's different. Most of California has gone to Austin, and big industries there, and Tesla's there, and so it's become like a Silicon Valley in with cowboys, you know.
Interesting image. Yeah. I mean, this place, Phoenix, is changing too. It's now, I think, the fourth largest city in the United States, which is surprising.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Phoenix. Sometimes we hear it's fifth, sometimes it's fourth. But yeah, so that's very different from the way it was when, even the first time I was coming here. Yeah.
Yeah. Austin is the eighth biggest now. Too,
really?
Interesting. Yeah. It was when I was there, it was a little live music capital of the world, very, very low key place, but it's certainly changed. Everything changes, right? But it stays the same.
That's the way the world works. Yeah. That's built into the operating system. So occasional upgrades. Your job is, how do you describe what your job is?
It's very interesting. I consider myself a story farmer. I farm stories, and I use various ways and techniques, either illustration, words, and sometimes photography. So I try in all the work I do is grow stories. What I've been doing for many years is writing and illustrating children's books, and mainly self-help books for kids, actually. So, helping kids deal with stuff they deal on a daily basis and using humor and whimsy to couch the information that I'm sharing with kids. So it's been an amazing journey, trying to find a comfortable way to deal with stuff that's quite difficult for kids. And so I've been using, and I'm a 14-year-old trapped in an older dude's body. So I just kind of tap into that sort of mischievous, immature side when I connect with kids, and it seems to have worked. So I've been able to carry on doing that for years and years.
It's such a cool idea as a category, which one doesn't even think exists really, but it makes sense. Self-help for kids. I mean, kids are adults or humans just like we are adults, but also there's a lot of things that, how do you learn? How do you learn stuff? You learn certain things from your parents, from your teachers, but there's a lot of things we could use help with. I remember when I was a kid, I was bullied. I had all kinds of losses in my life, so forth. There was just nobody who even really thought about that as a thing to talk to a kid about. If things got too bad and you were destructive, you'd get sent to a counselor or something. But other than that, just as a normal functioning kid, the way normal functioning adults need help, it just kind of didn't exist, right?
Yeah, it didn't. I mean, we didn't even have counselors when I was at school. And I was bullied a lot too. But what I found is that oftentimes, if you give kids permission to ask for support, that's really what my books do. It's like it's giving them avenues to be able to figure out how they can get support, whether it's from a peer, whether it's from a parent, whether it's from a teacher, and how to go about getting that support. And also to let them know that being supported or asking for support. And I don't like to use the word help, really, because if you are, it infers that someone's helpless if you are going to help them. They're not helpless. They just need direction. And supporting them and trying to let them know that they are not weak or not incapable if they ask somebody for support. And, just giving them permission. Because what do we do most of the time as adults? We tell kids what we think they want to hear instead of listening to what they're asking for. A child comes and tells you they've got a problem and you say, don't worry, it's going to be okay. Well, that comforts you as the teller. The kid then feels empty. It's like, well, they don't understand what I'm going through, or they're telling me it's okay. That doesn't make me feel any different. And so what we try and do is through these words and pictures, give them permission and ways to get the support they need.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about when I was probably 9 or 10. I was living in Israel, so I was an outsider kid because I was always a weird foreigner. And there was this one kid who started picking on me, and then one day he pushed me to the ground, and my head hit a rock, and so I was bleeding, like, really, you know how you bleed when you get hit in the head, and so I'm bleeding, and then that a teacher noticed, of course, like blood everywhere, and and so what she did is she took me home. And we didn't live that far from the school, I guess. And I just remember my mother, like, the teacher ringing the doorbell, my mother opening the door, seeing me, she grabbed me and pulled me into the house and slammed the door in the teacher's face. And then she's like, well, what happened? You know, and I said, well, you know, this kid pushed me down. And she was like, I don't think she had any idea what to do, honestly, either. You know, I think she didn't know, like, do you go and make a fuss at the school? You know, and the whole thing was just a mess. I mean, I remember it pretty clearly. And I remember the weird thing about being a kid is you have to then go back into the same situation the next day. So it's kind of like if that happens to you in prison, they put you in seclusion, right? But if it happens to you in school, it's kind of like, well, there you go again.
You have to go back the next day. And if a parent intervenes, that sometimes makes it worse.
Yeah,
because then the next day, when no one's around, they're saying, "Oh, you know, you can't handle your own
tattletale
and tattletale." And I had a very interesting situation when I was at school with bullies, and that's one of the reasons I wrote a book called "Bullies Are a Pain in the Brain," just very simple steps. I was bullied, like you were at school, a lot. There were in the particular area I lived, I'm a Jew. There were very few. I consider myself a wandering Jew because I sort of really like to follow the sort of a Buddhist philosophy. So a Jew-boo, if you like. But there was quite a lot of that anti-Semitism around. And there were these two older boys that every single day they would smack me around at the bus stop. Now, we took public transport to get to and from school. It was those red double-decker buses like they have in London we had. And man, those kids, you'd get upstairs, the driver couldn't see a thing, and they'd smack you around. And this went on until, goodness, a 10th grade. And one day these two guys had cornered me at the bus stop, and we wore school uniforms to school. They still do over there, all the schools, not just private schools. And they had me by the tie, and they were pulling me around on the ground like a dog with a chain, a collar around his neck. And just at that time, these three guys came around the corner who were in the rugby team. And one of them was like the school hero that everybody, I mean, teachers would fall over themselves to say hi to him. He was just a phenomenal guy, great, wonderful dude, big boy. And he saw what was going on, and these kids left me alone and sort of wandered away as if they weren't doing anything. And he just walked up to them and he said, "Hey, listen." He looks at me and says, "What's your name?" I said, "Trevor." He said, "If I ever see you guys within 10 feet of Trevor ever again, you will wish you were not born." And you know what? It stopped. The next day, they left me alone and school became cool. My last 2 years of school were fantastic because I didn't sit and start getting stressed, you know, second period from the end, because I knew I had to run that gauntlet to get to the bus. And, you know, my parents were like, "You know what? It's going to be okay. Just, you know, just you'll handle it. Only two more years." Like, "Oh, yeah, thanks." So what happened was they left me alone. And, you know, every time I'd walk through the corridors at school, and he was three or four grades older than me, he would nod at me and I'd say hi to him very proudly. Fast forward 30 years, when Al Gore invented the internet, I decided that I was going to look this guy up. So I found his email address. And this was before we had all FaceTime and what have you. Found his email address through our school association. I was like, "Damn." So I wrote him a letter. His name was Shane Carty. I said, "Dear Shane, I just wanted to write this letter to you to thank you. You did something amazing for me. You changed my life, really. You made me a much happier person, and I just wanted to say thanks. I never got an opportunity to actually come up and thank you. And I didn't know how anyway. I was too shy. I get a letter back. Dear Trevor, thank you very much for your letter. I don't remember you. I don't remember the incident. He said, but when I read your email, I just burst into tears and cried. I am so proud of what I did. He said, and I showed the email to my daughters and they cried. So thank you so much. I'm so glad I did that. And sadly, Shane passed away last year, but I was in touch with him after that all the time. And I share a lot of that story with kids because it's going to be the bystanders really who are going to have the power to stop stuff that goes on, because right. Invariably they are egging people on or too afraid to get involved. So the Shane Carty effect was life-changing for me.
That's amazing. That's an amazing story.
And that's when I wrote my book, I had that in the back of my mind all the way along.
Bullying is, and bullying isn't just for kids. I mean, we've seen a lot of bullying going on in the public square these days too.
Sure.
Bullying is a problem that we can continue living with. And Vicky's, and so often kids who are bullies, we think of them as sort of other, you know, we think of them as a monster or as evil in some way. And so often they have something going on, you know, that nobody's talking to them. So we vilify them.
Sure.
But they obviously.
Yeah, 90% of the time, according to the research that I was doing, that kids who are bullying have got something going on. They're either going through, you know, a family problem. They may be struggling with depression or, you know, bipolarism, or, you know, there's different stuff that triggers them, and they go for the weakest link. I'm small. I was so small when I was a kid, I had to climb on a chair just to reach puberty. So just a little dude. And so I was target, you know, but most of the time the kids have something going on.
So to switch gears a bit. So you kind of, how did you come to this? Talk a bit about your earlier working life and so forth and how you ended up in this situation.
I started off in advertising. Actually, I went to work for an agency. So we had to do military service in South Africa. I had to do 2 years. Came back from my deployment and sort of messing around at universities. Finally, sort of got through basically half correspondence, half popping in and visiting. And my next door neighbor had an ad agency, which was part of Gray Advertising. It was a small little umbrella ad agency. And he said, so what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, well, why don't you come and come work as a junior at the ad agency? He said, I know you're a creative kid, because I was always playing my guitar or messing around with paints or whatever. And he was friends with my family. So I said, sure. Okay. So I thought that would be a good idea. Advertising sounded fun. I get to the little ad agency. And on the very first day, he says to me, hey, listen, can you paint? I said, yeah, you know, a little bit. I messed around with watercolors and stuff. And he said, okay. He hands me cans of paint and overalls and a roller. And my first 10 days of working, for Bridge Advertising was painting the offices. So that was my, but what happened was while I was painting, there were people working in the graphics department. They were brainstorming ads. And I, while I was painting, I threw in my 2 cents and the idea worked. And so then he made me a junior art director. But what happened was that I found that I was coming up with the copy more than the art ideas, and eventually became a copywriter, went through the apprenticeship years, then became a creative director. Then I moved to the US because I couldn't get any books published in South Africa. And I was passionate about children's books. I always found them such a great avenue to adventure. And, as a kid who struggled with learning, my parents used to read to me, and the books became sort of magical places for me. And I always wanted to write children's books. And then actually one day I actually got fired from an ad agency because the guy said, you know, you're wasting your time. Why don't you go write children's books? Because that's where your passion is. So I thought, wow, I tried to get published in South Africa. There was no chance. At that time, it was in the thick of apartheid. And, you know, it was just, that wasn't something a priority. And I didn't like the situation. I hated being there, the way people were treated. So I moved to the US and found a job at an ad agency, but started really heavily working on my books and sent the books out and got rejection after rejection after rejection. I think I had 400 rejections. And then one day somebody said, hey, we'll publish this book. And the book's still in print, which I'm pretty happy to say. It's called What on Earth Do You Do When Somebody Dies? And basically it was how to help kids understand grief. And we're actually doing a second edition right now. And that book's been out for 23, 24 years or something. So I started doing the children's books, writing them. And as you know, you don't necessarily get a next book from a publisher if you had one, even if it's successful. If they are not that excited about it, it doesn't get to happen. But what happened was I started going to schools to talk about writing and about the books. And I found that I could do what I called stand-up education. I was basically using stand-up comedy, talking to the kids, but then weaving the information in between the humor. And it worked. It worked like crazy. I've been doing it for many years now. I've spoken to 1.5 million kids over the last 20 years in 16 countries. And I found that I could connect with them using humor and whimsy, which my drawings are. And that was how it sort of evolved into having a company that creates materials for kids. And then working with terminally ill kids, which I've been doing for many years, how do you use creativity to help people who have, or kids who have gone through trauma, and then military kids whose parents have PTSD. So it's sort of become this organic movement where I work with these different populations, plus write my books, plus do my illustrations. And so sort of like a creative smorgasbord, if you like. And I'm very lucky I've been able to sort of cobble all that stuff together and make a living and live in Hawaii.
The amazing thing about you also is you don't have kids and you actually hate kids, right? I remember you telling me.
I forgot to have kids.
Too busy talking to kids to have one.
Too busy. But I when I started going to the hospital to visit kids who have cancer, I sort of got a family of kids. And then I was on the board of the American Childhood Cancer Association for many years. And so the kids that I've worked with and helped, and many of them I still get letters from when they're in their 30s now, they became my children. And quite honestly, Danny, I don't think I'd be able to do what I did if I had children. Because going into a hospital and sitting with a child who you know is going to die, you know, having a child, I don't think I could actually stomach it. And what I learned to do was sit in that discomfort with the kids where everybody else would scatter. And that was the gift that I got from the universe. You know, you can sit and be with somebody and it's not your fault that they're dying and you can't fix them. So just be with them. And I don't believe I'd be able to do it if I had my own kids.
Having kids read your books, are they generally read like in school? Are they read with other people? Are they read with a teacher? Do they read it on their own? What do you think the main way they consume it is?
The majority of my books are given to kids by school counselors. Many school counselors, or most school counselors, I would say, have my books in their office. And if a kid comes in who's having a bully problem or a click problem or a stress problem, they give them the books and or they recommend them to the parents, and then the parents will go onto the website and get them, you know, Amazon or whatever. So that's pretty much been the way that the self-help books, the picture books that I've done, and I did a book of it was a visual diary of growing up in South Africa, where I just did little sketches and little anecdotes. And that sold just because I put two or three of those on to Facebook. And my goodness, those things went mad. People just cut and pasted them. My mom was getting these things that they were saying, she said, you should see this. This is really funny. And this is so poignant. And, you know, my name is at the bottom, you know.
Oh, mom.
Mom says, you should see this. I said, Mom, I did those, you know.
But I remember when you were doing those, that, and they were sort of about like the common memories of things that we, that only somebody who grew up in South Africa would know about,
yes.
You know,
yeah.
Like the funny things of life.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, the silly little colloquial phrases and the different foodstuffs that we had in just in that particular area. So it was a very localized book. But what I found interesting is that people like to read it because it almost, they ask the question, what is that? And how did you do that? And I didn't think South Africa was like that. You know, I grew up in a bubble, you know, being a privileged white person. And, but I was, in this book, I talked a lot about some of the black kids that I had. And the housekeeper refused to speak to me in English, and she only spoke to me in Tswana. And I got to learn and understand that language. And you know, I used a little bit of that in the book, and that endeared a lot of people who you know were on the edges at that time.
So that's an example, I think, of having like just a creative idea. It isn't necessarily like part of a business strategy. It clearly didn't have anything to do with the main thing that you do. I think that that's an interesting kind of phenomenon, and I think that you have it as much as I do, where you just have an idea, you think it's cool, you want to see it happen, you start working on it, and, you know, suddenly it exists, right?
Yeah, it took its own path. You know, I never did that for any audience at all. I was actually chatting to my brother and sister, and one day, while we were talking, I was speaking to my brother about how when we were kids at school, we got corporal punishment. And if you, and I'm sure some of the schools you went to as well in different countries, if you open your mouth in class, you know, you get up to the front or you go to the headmaster's office and he whacks you with a cane. Well, we were discussing how many different implements of abuse those teachers had. There was one teacher who used a ping pong bat. There was another guy who used a track from those electric little plastic racing cars. And so I drew those on a napkin while I was speaking to my brother. And I was like, this was fun. So I did a whole bunch of them to send to my brother and sister. And I just took photographs of those napkins. And my brother popped one on his Facebook, and all of a sudden people started sharing it. So I was like, oh, okay, it wasn't a financial decision at all. That was something that was really fun. But I think because I wasn't pressured into thinking about my target audience, I just really did what I wanted to do. And my downfall on a number of books is that I sometimes think, oh, this is, people want this. And when every time I do that, it just doesn't work.
You know, or it doesn't sell. It's, in other words, the difference between a passion project of something that you really love versus smart business decision, right?
Yes.
Or a good line extension or something like that. No, I understand that distinction. It's funny you saying about that story about the drawings of the napkins is my mom just wrote her memoir of growing up in Pakistan. And, you know, my mother's not that much older than me. She was like 21 when I was born. So in some ways, her descriptions of her growing up there are similar to mine, because I lived there when I was a kid multiple times. And, you know, just all these little tiny things, you know, the names of things and the kinds of language. And there's like in Pakistan, there's, you know, people who are Anglo-Indians. So in other words, they have maybe one European or American parent and then an Indian mother, let's say, you know, there's a thing where they're like trying to pass, quote unquote, as, you know, full-blown English, but then the giveaway will be the sort of pidgin English that they'll use certain terms. There'll be certain kind of words you use that you know, yeah. give it away. And there's all these little sort of very, very localized things that you would only ever know if you live there. And even things like the very particular kind of candy that you could only buy at the zoo or the bookstore and the chemist that was next to each other. I mean, everybody has that, but I think particularly if you've lived in another culture and then you come to America, those are the things that you hearken back to. And it's great that you collected them.
You hearken back. And what's quite interesting is that I'll sometimes sort of lapse into asking saying to my wife, you know, I want to go get some, you know, what type of candy? And she goes, I want an Aero or whatever. She goes, we don't have those. So then I draw myself one.
There you go.
It's like
now the internet. The internet's ruined a lot of it because now you can actually get virtually anything.
Yes, you can. You can order it.
Yeah.
But you know what? A lot of doing what I did in those drawings was inspired by you because, you know, when Everyday Matters came out, you know, you'd drawn stuff, you'd drawn your breakfast or you'd drawn guitars or things that, you know, that, and I was like, I resonated with that so much because I need to draw the stuff I'm thinking about. And
what difference does that make? What difference does it make to draw it, you think?
You know, that's a great question. There is a real, it's like satisfaction. I feel good. It must be a release of endorphins or something, that action. And it's also very meditative. You know, while I'm drawing, I'm thinking about what it is and I'm thinking about what it means to me. So it's not just a 2D thing on paper. There's a lot of depth to creating stuff like that in particular. And, you know, I've had people send me stuffed candies that I couldn't get here before the internet sort of became easy enough to do it. You know, my mom would send me a care package and before I ate them, I drew them. And then, you know, asked my mom to take a picture of the coffee percolator that she's had for like 300 years at home, which looks like some kind of a spacecraft, you know, one of those French press strange angular things. And that's so cool to draw. So.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea, even if you don't draw, quote unquote, is to go and like record all of those things. You know, you can take a snapshot of them, but I think to draw all of those things that you remember or things that, as you say, in your mom's house or, you know, stuff from your kids' toys, you know, that your kids may be adults by now, but you might, all those kinds of things, to do just a visual record of them and to try and think of them in as much detail as possible as you're drawing them. So to say, like, what exactly would wheels on that toy car like, or, you know, what expression did that doll have on its face, to try and go there and get as deep as you can and then write with it. I mean, what I love about what you do is you like to always make pictures with words together, that the two things resonate with each other. And that combination, I think, is really a powerful memory tool and a great way of creating an archive of your past.
Absolutely. And that I learned directly from you, to be honest. I mean, because I never would put words with pictures, but reading that book and seeing, and especially the handwritten note next to it, not something that you put on a computer, then type next to it, that resonated with me. And what I found, which was really interesting, was when I was drawing stuff, and when I draw stuff now, I look at it and I'm like, geez, somebody thought about this. So, and then even if you look at a candy wrapper, like some dude had to go to the client, had to draw this, had to make this typography work like that. that wasn't just, all of a sudden here it is. I'm eating the candy and I'm throwing that package away. So it's making me look at things a little differently. The other day I was waiting for somebody, and the only thing that I could draw was my printer for my computer. And I thought, man, you know, there are people like the influencers and celebrities and Kardashians and what have you, who get so much attention. The dude who invented inkjet printers, we don't know who that guy is, but man, how does that dot know where to go on that photograph? Because there's a million little dots. And I was thinking while I'm drawing, I'm like, wow, some guy figured this out. That's a hero to me.
So even more ingenious. Even more ingenious was the guy who figured out that you can charge like $30 for one of those cartridges. That was the real
genius. Yes, that's right. The dude. That was the dude who was grinding the ink, I think. But Danny, to go back one step about talking about putting things down, what I've found a lot with kids often is that sometimes they can't express themselves with words. And I will say to them, how would that look? How would what you're feeling look like as a drawing? And I said, not just an angry scribble, because that's easy to do. That's a cop out. Show me what your feelings look like. And it's remarkable how, they'll find different perspectives, different ways to express how they're feeling. And a great example of this, which worked amazingly well, was, so I do a lot of work with kids whose parents are deployed. I created a deployment kit, and in it is a journal with little prompts so you can draw and write. And so the kids get a journal, they get postcards to send to their parent, because I'm trying to get kids to at least figure out what a stamp is and to draw something to send to their dad to put in his barracks or wherever, or mom, wherever it is. And so I got an email from a young girl, I think she's 9 years old, and the email said, "Dear Trevor, I wrote and drew my feelings in my journal that you gave me, like you asked us to, when my daddy was deployed. And when my daddy came back from the war, I showed him my journal. And my daddy started to cry. And when my daddy started to cry, that's when I knew my daddy got his feelings back. And when my daddy got his feelings back, that's when I knew I got my daddy back." And just the act of her, on just a few pages, putting down her real feelings, reconnected her with her dad when he came back. And often that reconnection can take months and months, but it brought the family together by simply even doing that. And I always suggest doing it even as an exercise, even couples sitting together. So, I'm angry, I'm frustrated. Well, show me, draw it. And let's each draw what we're feeling. So it works really well.
That's a wonderful story. And such a big impact that you made on their lives. I want to ask you about kids you deal with in even more extreme situations. You work with child soldiers in Africa. Can you talk a bit about that experience? And did drawing have anything to do with that? Do those kids draw?
Sure. Yeah, I've done some work with the United Nations in Uganda, Burundi, Rwanda, Central Africa. And I went with a group who were advocating against child soldiers. So what I did was when the group went and had meetings with warlords and what have you, I went to the local orphanages or refugee camps, and I drew with kids and I shared stories of them, which was really fascinating because, English is not their first language, but they know quite a lot of English from watching television, yeah. American television. So they know. It's quite interesting. And through translators and what have you. So being able to sit and draw and work with those kids was phenomenal. But drawing was, on one particular day, was a very interesting central part of how I connected with these kids. So first of all, when I arrived in in Rwanda. It was in the Congo. Sorry. They're all very close together. So I was in the Congo and we got put in this big Quonset hut and there was a guy giving us direction about where we were going to go. There was Doctors Without Borders there, Psychologists Without Borders. And we were all getting sort of sent to different areas. We would have a driver. We went in the UN vehicles. And when I was at school, at high school, I wanted to take art as an elective. And my art teacher told me I wasn't talented enough. So actually, I didn't draw for about 5 or 6 years after that because I showed him my little journal with sketches and he said, no, that's cartooning. That's not art. So I didn't draw until I started getting in the ad business and all those markers were around. I'm like, then I have to play with those things. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you remember the British, they had things called magic markers. They were this big, you know, with ink in them with a little nip. They were great. So cut back to we're in this hut and the guy says, okay, so now each of you, you're going to get your papers and a driver. What is going to happen is your driver is going to take you where you will need to go. Now, if anybody stops you, you just keep quiet and you give him your papers, okay? Guy puts up his hand and said, excuse me, what do you mean if anybody stops you? He goes, no, it's not a problem. Sometimes they kidnap people, but just for one day and we pay them the money. And another guy says, excuse me, what do you mean kidnap? He goes, no. You see, they just take you, they lock you in a toilet or in a storeroom, and we pay them a $20, $50, and they let you. Oh, it's just extortion. You know, they just want to bribe people. But don't worry, your driver knows what to do. I say, okay, sweet. So we get in the car and we're driving, and my driver is a great guy. He's talking up a storm, telling me about the whole place. And we're driving down these roads, and there's little huts and villages on our way. The corn is being ground in those big corn grinders. And I'm like, man, I'm in heaven. This is fabulous. We come over a rise and there is a sentry box and a boom across the road with two Congolese soldiers. Now, you could have driven around the boom because there was nothing on either side. I mean, it was farmlands, fields. But we come to a stop and I look over at my driver and his eyes are bigger than saucers. This guy is, I mean, he's bewildered. His knuckles are white on the steering wheel. He's not saying a word. And these soldiers, they'd obviously seen the movie Rambo. Their sleeves were rolled up. They had bullet belts, grenades. One guy had an old green rusty rocket launcher. It was one of those old Russian things with a little rocket, like a mortar on the top rocket kind of thing. And so one of the guys comes and he looks in the window and he says, where are you going? I said, so I'm going to the Don Bosco orphanage to work with children. He goes, what work are you going to do with the children? I said, so I'm going to sort of do some like art therapy. I didn't know what to call what I was going to do. And he goes, where are your papers? I give the dude my papers. He looks at them. He walks around back to where the other guy is, and they start having the biggest argument. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I'm going to be somebody's wife tonight. This may be a tough time for me. The guy comes back, and he looks in the window again. He says, where are you going? I said, sir, I'm going to the Don Bosco orphanage. What are you going to do there? I said, so I'm going to do art. He goes, what art? So I happened to have my journal on my lap because I was just taking notes of different things so I could remember them. And it's a little sketch journal. It had a zillion little sketches in. And this dude grabs it out of the window, licks his finger, and I was looking through my personal journal. He's just looking at it. There was a picture that I'd drawn of somebody wearing a T-shirt with a Mickey Mouse on the T-shirt. And his eyes light up and he goes, You draw this? I said, yes, sir. He said, can you draw me? I said, okay. So he stands to attention. He salutes. I mean, there's sunglasses on, beret, you know, just a badass looking guy. And I said, okay. So I drew a little quick little caricature. Just terrible. It was a really bad sketch of the guy. Because to tell the truth, my hand was shaking. you know, it was looking like a New Yorker cartoon, but I wasn't doing that on purpose, you know, the drawing. And I give it to the guy and he looks at me and he goes, you are a cartoon man. Can you draw my friend? I'm like, okay. He calls over the other guy. Hey, Clio, where? The other dude comes running over with his rocket launcher. And so I say, stand back to me. He stands back very proudly. I do a little sketch of him. He takes his thank, says, thank you. They open the boom and I drive out. They say, bye, cartoon man. I was like, wow. As we're driving, I look over at my driver. He goes, I think I know those guys. What do you mean you think you know those guys? I'm dying. He said, yes, I think they live in my neighborhood. Anyway, so the next day we come back because I went there for a week every day. And so we leave the UN compound. We're driving back. And I wondered if I was going to see my friends. We come over the hill. They're gone. We drive about 3 miles down the road, come over another little rise, and there they are again. They're still guarding nothing. I pull up. That same dude comes around. He looks in the window and he says, where are you going? I said, sir, I'm going to the Don Bosco orphanage. He goes, cartoon man. Hey, open the bloody gate, man. And other dude opened the gate. And every day they were in a different part of the thing. And my dream one day, if he's still alive, is to tell my art teacher that, you know what, my little sketches that you thought weren't art probably saved my hide on one day. But when I got to the orphanage, that was life changing for me because I have never seen dirtier, poorer, more traumatized kids in my life. They had 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. They'd been kidnapped, forced to be child soldiers. They fed them with a mixture of cocaine and gunpowder, which they call bang bang. And, you know, these kids were scrawny and they used these kids just as labor, basically. And so they asked me if I would present, do some work with some of the kids in the classroom. There were about 30 of these kids. And Danny, I walked in their classroom and I saw these little kids sitting on the dirt floor, smashed out windows. They had these little chalkboards in their hands. And the most hollow eyes I've ever seen in my life. It looked like, you know, when an animal is stuffed on the wall, those eyes are empty. These kids had empty eyes. And I felt like a fraud. I felt terrible. I wanted to turn around and run out of there because I thought, what the hell am I doing trying to help these kids who've been through 10 times more than I will ever go through in 10 lifetimes? My stomach churned and I felt terrible. It was like that, you know, fright or flight. I wanted to run out of there. I was so uncomfortable. And the guys who were helping me, they were speaking to the kids. Oh, this guy, he's a funny guy. He's going to make you laugh. And so I thought, okay, Mr. Kumbaya is going to come and save Africa. You know, this white guy is going to go and save all these kids, you know. And I had my little pieces of paper and my donated Crayola boxes, and it was going to be great. Well, not so. So I'm thinking, I'm here. I've got to do something because the silence was so awkward. So I give them all a piece of paper. The guy hands out the papers, puts them in front of every kid, gives them their little crayon box. And I say, okay, guys, I want you to draw your feelings. Mm. You know, and as I was saying it, I just heard Jack Handy from, you know, Saturday Night Live, whatever that was like. And I heard this music and I thought, oh, my God, this is so fake. This is so horrible. Please let me be somewhere else. And so they're all sitting there. Now, they're not drawing any feelings. They're looking at me like I'm mad. So I say, well, okay, draw anything. You know, draw a car or something. They're looking at me, not inspired, not motivated. So I'm starting to scramble and thinking, how can I connect with these kids? I don't know. I'm never going to talk to them because I just don't know. I have nothing, zero in common with them, nothing. And I'm flipping through my little mental Rolodex, and I always tell kids, a Rolodex is something that, and then it's too hard to explain. But and I'm thinking, and then I realized all these kids were orphans. Their parents had all been killed. They were kidnapped from places where they were being sort of harbored and looked after. And I had lost my dad. So I thought, you know what? the thing we have in common is that we have lost a parent. So I said, let me show you something. This is what I mean. And I drew a picture of my dad, and he had really cool moustache, and I drew the picture, and I held it up. I said, this is my daddy, and he died. Now, when my dad died, I didn't grieve for him. I was taking care of my mom and my brother and sister. I pushed those feelings down. I couldn't cope with them. I was trying to be strong, and I didn't allow myself to cry. And for years, I just didn't grieve properly for my dad. And I'm pointing to this picture of my father and said, this is my dad. He was such a nice man. And all of a sudden, I hear this howl like a wolf. And I look around, I'm thinking, what the hell is that? Hearing this noise. And then I realized it was me. My grief came out. I was in the most vulnerable position in my life. I felt terrible. I was depressed just being there. I had no defenses. It came out and I started sobbing. I put my head on my hands on that. There was a little desk. I put my head on my hands and I'm crying. I mean, I'm inconsolable. I look up and these kids are now, they're leaning forward, and now they are bewildered too. I put my head down, and a little kid comes up to me, in the front, and he goes, it's okay. It's okay. He's patting me on the arm. Now, that makes me cry even more, because now this dude is taking care of me. And I look up, and all these kids are sort of looking at me, and you know what? Now, through the translator, they're like, oh, what now? I said, I work with a lot of children who have cancer, who are very sick, and a lot of those children have died. But a lot of those kids are very strong, and they're fighting it. And I miss them. Now I'm just a blithering idiot. I put down my head, and I'm crying even more. I hear this strange noise, another strange noise. It's like, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And I look up, and these kids are drawing on their pieces of paper. They all started just putting stuff down. I'm like, oh, okay, I put my head down quickly. I didn't want to stop. And I hear somebody clearing their throat. And one of the older boys who could speak English, he says, excuse me, what is cancer? I realized the kids don't know what that word is. They probably never heard that word in their lives. And I said, oh, well, let me tell you. And I explained that I work at a hospital with kids who are very, very sick. I found I was talking about some of the sicknesses, and a few of the kids said, oh, is it like Ebola? And I said, yeah, you know, kind of thing. And I said, and there was one little boy who I used to work with. And I went to go visit him in the hospital. And one day he took his apple juice that he was drinking. You know what apple juice is? Yes, yes, yes. I said, so he was supposed to pee in a container to test his urine. And they're all sniggling now. Oh. I said, but he poured the apple juice in. And when the nurse came to get the container, he picked it up and he drank it. And the nurse thought he was drinking his own pee. And the nurse got so angry. And so everybody was like, these kids were roaring. We talked a bit about it. They asked me more stories. They asked me to tell that story 100 times that week. Kids, I told it over and over and over again. They just wanted to hear about the pee in the cup. But what happened was, during that week, we bonded really amazingly, because the art was the common ground. I would sit and start a picture and they would finish it. Or they would start a picture and I would finish it. And we just connected really nicely. And, you know, as we went every day, we grew closer and closer. And it was, there weren't very many words that had to be said. We did a lot of it through drawing and through expression. And on the last day, I came in there and I said to the guys, well, you know, guys, today I'm leaving this afternoon, and it's so nice to get to know you. Little guy put up his hand. He said, excuse me, can you tell us about the guy who peed in the cup, please? I'm like, okay, I'm going to tell you that story one more time, and that's it. I told the story. We all went off and got a little lunch snacks that they'd provided. We come back and I said, okay, guys, before I go, I want to know from you guys, What do you love most in the whole world? I want you to tell me. Oh, they started putting up their hands and getting excited. I said, yes. And one boy said, we love ice cream. I said, what do you mean? Oh, no, we love, sir, you know what ice cream is? I said, yes, yes. I said, we love ice cream. Now, apparently, UNICEF had brought those kids ice cream the week before with all the salt rocks that actually made it. And these kids were trying to describe what it tasted like to me, which was, it was amazing, trying to describe the taste of the ice cream. Anyway, I said, okay, well, guys, draw your ice cream, draw your faces, draw your expressions. And so they were drawing what they were feeling like when they had the ice cream and what have you. And then one more time, they wanted to hear about the kids with cancer. And I said, no, I'm not telling you anymore. I've got to say goodbye. Now my heart is breaking because I don't want to say goodbye to these kids. Now they're my kids, you know. So we get in the vehicle, the United Nations Jeep, and it's dusty. And the kids came to the gate to say goodbye to me. Now in Africa, the tradition when a group says goodbye to someone, they normally sing and dance. And so they got together, these kids, and they did this little dance and they were singing and saying thank you. They were so excited. And so I tell the driver, go, we've got to go. My heart's breaking. I can't stand this anymore. I'm going to break down. Let's go. So I wave out the window and we start driving. Well, all of a sudden, one of the kids who was in that group breaks away from the crowd and he's running next to the vehicle and he's banging on the side of it, screaming for us to stop. Well, I tell the driver to stop and wind down the window. And there's dust everywhere because we'd screeched to a stop. And this little boy shoves his head in the window and he's clutching a little drawstring purse. And I'm like, what is that? And he goes, mister, it's for you, for you, for you. And so I took the purse out of his hand and I said, oh, it's a little drawstring bag, actually. I said, what is it? He said, open, open. So I opened the bag and inside was a coin. It was a British coin from 1890. It had Queen Victoria on the back and some little coat of arms on the front. I don't know where that little boy got that coin. It was probably his only treasure because they had little boxes by their beds, little Tupperwares where they had their own little personal stuff. Who knows where he got that? Anyway, so I looked at it and I think he wanted validation of how beautiful this little coin was. I said, wow, you're so lucky. This is very beautiful. And I handed it back to him. And he goes, no, 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 no. You must take it. I said, no way. I mean, that's your treasure. I can't take it. It's fine. I have money at home. Thank you. It's not a problem. He goes, no, no, mister, please. You must take this money. And when you go home, you must use it to buy ice cream for the kids with cancer. And I did. I took the coin, which I still keep with me today. I've shown that to 500,000 children at assemblies, because I didn't want to, hurt his feelings by not, you know, fulfilling his dream of buying ice cream for kids, and it was amazing to me the empathy that little boy had, and what made that little boy who has nothing find it in his heart to give something that maybe a lot of money to him or sentimental value to be able to help somebody else. And that's what I tell kids. I say to kids, that's what it's all about. And when I'm in my assemblies, I say, listen, you have two choices when you walk outside this door today. The first choice is you can be the same person who walked in. And the second choice is you can walk outside and you can be a kinder person. And it's not difficult. It's actually harder to be mean than to be kind. And it's quite amazing how just that story opens up kids' hearts and how they want to. And I tell them, don't wait for grown-ups to change the world. They take too long and they have too many meetings. And that's how I finish my assemblies. And so in a nutshell, that's a very long story for a quick story about the orphanage.
It's a fantastic story. It's very moving, but it also, as you said, I think it's full of a lot of wisdom too. And also about the incredible power that art can have to help us heal and help us
absolutely
find our feelings that are buried deep within us. So It's amazing how often I encounter people, I'm sure you do too, who just are afraid of art, can't go near it. You know, it's not for me. I'm not an artist, blah, blah, blah. And it's like this incredible, it's like that coin. It's like this incredible treasure that we have that we can use in beautiful, important ways. And the children know. Children understand this. Children understand the power of this tool, and they know how to use it. Every child does. And we forget. It's like this incredible kind of spell that's cast over us at a certain point.
Cast over us. I would say, Danny, honestly, 80% of the people I meet say, oh, I can't draw.
Right.
And yet I sometimes see people who have made a little collage or something for a greeting card, and I'm like, wow, that's really creative. And I think being judged is, you know, being judged as not being good because you can't do a likeness exactly of something. And I think that's how people restrict themselves by trying to do something that looks exactly like something else. Danny, have you read that book called Orbiting the Giant Hairball?
A long time ago,
Long time. Oh, it's an old book. It's probably old 15 book, years old or something. It was about the guy who went in and turned Hallmark around to be something. And he tells a story in there about how when he went to schools to sort of research creativity, he would go into a kindergarten class and ask kids, how many of you are artists? And every single one, you know, puts up their hand. And as you go higher and higher, and then, you know, you get to 12th grade and they're two like goth kids who are like, hey, yeah, man, I am. I've heard that story, you know, from other people too. It's just, when do we tell ourselves we can't do it? And that's where we have to try, and that's the seal that I'm hoping that I can break with children, is to not put that little seal on top and say, okay, I can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, I hear from so many people when I share stories of disastrous experiences I had with teachers and adults when it came to art when I was little. And everybody has these stories about teachers like the one that you mentioned who said, you know, cartooning is an art. People who can derail an entire person's life with a sentence, unfeeling, unthinking. People who presumably cared about children, devoted their lives to being teachers. It's a really tough job. I'm sure you wouldn't do it just for the money. And yet how easy it is to trip somebody up at a really crucial point, or alternatively to do what you're doing, which is to take those skills that people have and show them early on, this is a tool that you can continue using. You don't have to be good at it. You don't have to draw like a photo, but it is a skeleton key that will unlock your feelings, your heart, and your perception of the world whenever you want to use it. So just have it. Don't reject it. Don't be afraid of it. Try it. So thank you so much for sharing all these stories.
Can I ask you one more question? When did you know that you were okay as an artist? I mean, internally, how young were you? I mean, have you been sketching? Because there is this tipping point, I think, as where you do something that you look at, you say, "Whoa, I feel good about that." You know, so I was wondering if there was a time for you when you.
I mean, no, still waiting. But I think that there are times throughout my life when I've made a drawing that I thought was really cool. And then there have been even when I was, you know, 12 or something or five. Mm-hmm. But I think there have been many, many more times when I've made art that made me feel terrible because it was not what I wanted it to be. And a lot of times you can just give up at that time. I think the key thing is like this notion of identity. And this is probably a topic for another conversation another day, but the idea of I'm an artist, I just don't know how useful I find it. Sometimes I find it useful to say to people, you have the power to think of yourself as an artist. And if you do, then you're enabled to do all these things that are creative things that you would like to be able to do. And the other times I think it doesn't really matter whether you are an artist or called an artist. That's not necessarily That's not necessarily a guarantee of anything. So why bother? Because so often it feels like a title you have to earn in some way. It's very complicated. Right. And I think you can make art and not be an artist. So focus on that part of it. Focus on making art, not on whether or not you're an artist, because I just don't know what the value of that is. I mean,
that
it could
is
be
very
a profession.
Profound.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a profession. Yeah, you could say I'm an artist and, you know, my paintings sell for X and I, you know, put that on my tax return. But other than that, I'm not sure what exactly its value is, unless it's to say, hey, this is art. Why? Because I'm an artist and I don't know that that's useful either. So I don't know. I've been wrestling with that term for a really long time and I'm, you know, I don't have a solid answer for you.
Yeah. I want a poster with those words on. So for the future.
Well, I'll print some up if I can do a good drawing to go with them. And if not, I'll just have to keep trying. Trevor, thanks so much. Thanks for everything that you've done, you know, in your life with kids. I think it is really valuable, and I'm really glad to be able to tell more people about it, because I think it's just really inspiring to think that you can not only help children, but I think you can help the children that we all still are, and that a lot of these issues that you talk about are still in us and still, you know, nobody ever helped us, and therefore we continue to carry around that wounded child inside of us. Art can help bring that out to some extent, but it's a really important thing, and it's so easy to hurt a child. Children are very resilient, but it's also so easy to damage a child without even knowing you're doing it. So,
well, Danny, I appreciate you very, very much. You know, over the years, you've been a really good sounding board for me when I've also been doubting myself. And I think that's one of the things that I encourage a lot of people who are maybe attempting to do something, attempting to draw, you know, find somebody you can, that's not, you don't criticize, you suggest, or you help facilitate the emotional part of it. Well, you've done that for me for over 20 years. And it's been incredibly helpful, and I really appreciate you.
Well, I'm glad that I have you as a friend. So let's leave it at that before we start bawling. I think there's been enough sobbing for one episode of a podcast. We're grown men, damn it. So thanks again. And
welcome.
I'm going to pause. Well, it was great fun talking with Trevor. I hope you enjoyed it too. We always have kind of deep and yet deeply funny conversations together. And I hope that it inspired you as well. His work with kids is incredible, but you should go and check out his other work, his website, his books that he's published, and learn more about Trevor Romaine. I'll be seeing you again next time for another chat about art and creativity. Thanks for joining me on Art for All. This is Danny Gregory. Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. And remember, visit sketchbookschool.com and claim your free ebook and your monthly newsletter. Our community is always growing, and we'd love for you to be a part of it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Art for All.